This podcast is a recording of a webinar held on September 23rd, 2020, around being a human rights-based organisation. This webinar really came at an exciting point in the consortium's own journey as an organisation. After being hosted and incubated really by Amnesty International for 4 years, the consortium was established as a SCIO, as a charity in its own right. But for the consortium and for civil society organisations in Scotland in general, what does it really mean to be human rights based? We hope you enjoy listening.
Okay, so without further ado, I'm delighted to introduce our first speaker, who many of you I know will know, actually. So Lucy Mulvey is the Policy and Communications Director at the Health and Social Care Alliance Scotland. Lucy is well involved in loads of things around human rights, is a massive advocate for human rights, both at national level and within organisations, and has got lots to say this morning. So, Lucy, I'll hand over to you.
So many thanks to Barry and to Rebecca, the team at Human Rights Consortium, for asking me to come along and speak today alongside Tessa and Naomi. I'm really delighted to be here. And I'm just going to really kind of be quite general in what I'm going to say, because I know that Naomi and Tress are probably going to be much more specific about their own organisations and organisational experiences. So I was asked to talk about what does it mean to be a human rights organisation. So I've got a few slides, but hopefully some of what I'll say will be of interest. It might give rise to some thoughts, but also some questions. So really looking forward to the chat later on. I was thinking about this and thinking about, for me, what are some of the key ingredients? And I suppose there's a number of different things that you can do, both practically and philosophically, to be a human rights organisation, but also to be an organisation that does human rights work. And I suppose there's something very fundamental about, as Vary said, about the sort of the walking the talk, but it being woven into the culture of the organisation. And certainly as a member of the very newly formed board of the Human Rights Consortium itself, it's something that I'm really looking forward to doing in my role as a board member, as a support to the organisation, looking at how do you do that, weave it into the DNA of the organisation from the very beginning. And one of the ways you can do that is by doing it within your own organisational policies. So whether that's HR policies, like having inequalities. Many of us are in organisations that have a standard, they have equalities policies, but can we look at making them equalities and human rights policies? But weaving in human rights into things like your communications, even your finance and procurement policies, who you will or won't do business with, for example. And also then the implementation of those policies at an organisational level, operationalising, for example, through staff training and continuing professional development and opportunities. And then, of course, just in terms of the activities and the outputs, so what the organisation actually does, as well as the kind of how do we do it. And, of course, there are a plethora of tools that already exist to enable us to do that. So whether that's carrying out equality impact assessments and human rights impact assessments about our work and also our activities, just to make sure, for example, that everybody's involved that needs to be involved and that we're not actually creating further barriers to engagement before we've even begun. I suppose one of the things that I would think is that we can use the very well-known human rights panel principles, which I'll come on to talk about in a minute or so, to look at using checking and planning checklist and planning tools. I think when you're looking at doing EQIAs and HRIAs, it is important to look beyond the protected characteristic groups, extremely important, but we do want to look beyond them and look at things like people's socioeconomic situations, for example, housing situations, things like that. And also even being curious and exploring issues around what's happened to people rather than what's wrong with them from a mental health background. So that's the approach that we would take. So also thinking about people who, you know, might be survivors of violence, maybe be survivors of trauma. I've been doing a lot of work around ACEs as well. And So it's often if you don't fit a particular protected characteristic group or you don't fit into that group or other, you can fall through the gaps. So it's maybe being a bit curious and widening the net that we would use to engage with people. I think a very important thing, really delighted to see Janice from Deaf Scotland on here today, is to be taking an inclusive communications approach from the very get-go. Ideally, we would be providing that as organisations as a matter of course rather than on demand. But of course, there's a balance and there's checks and balances with that. We know because of sometimes the cost of that and the fact that civil society organisations aren't often very well funded to ensure that. One of the things the Alliance have been trying to do is, as a matter of course, provide BSL interpretation and digital note-taking, whether people have asked for it or not, as a way of basically demonstrating that we want to include as many people as possible, that they don't need to ask to be involved. And last but not least is kind of taking an outcomes-focused approach. I'll come on and talk a bit more about that and how we can weave that in with the panel principles, I think. But another thing that's really important to do as part of your tools, I think, is monitoring and evaluation, and something as an organisation we certainly consistently call at the Alliance for others to do. We need robust data gathering. We need robust intersectional analysis in order to identify what works and what doesn't for particular groups. And then if I come on to then the principles and the kind of fundamental human rights principles, which many of you will be aware of, what we can do is we can weave those into our organisational vision, mission, statements and aims. One of the things in a previous organisation I worked for we had was a kind of value statement of what you can expect from working with us, which was very heavily equalities and human rights based. And I think helped to then give people who were going to engage with the organisation an understanding from the very get-go of what we were kind of all about and that we were trying to walk that talk. We all know the panel principles. It's a really good place to start, I think, from a policy, but actually from an operations point of view as well. And we can think about using these in a practical but creative way. For example, by mainstreaming them into our outcomes-focused approach as the organisation delivers its work, but also goes about doing its work. Participation is a means and a goal in and of itself, much like the right to participation is a right in and of itself, but it's also fundamental to the realisation of other rights. We need to make sure that processes and outcomes are closely monitored, as I've said, that the strategies and activity of the organisation is about empowering rights holders, but it's also about ensuring that duty bearers understand their obligations and are not necessarily empowered to be able to actually do them, but at least know what they ought to be doing. I think civil society plays a huge role in Scotland, as elsewhere, in informing and raising the awareness of duty bearers. And that we need to make sure from the non-discrimination and equality principle that the activities we're doing are promoting and giving voice to those most marginalised and pushed to the edges in society. And as an organisation, last but not least, in the civil society sphere, I think from an accountability point of view, and I'll kind of finish on this note, there's no harm in us thinking of ourselves as duty bearers as well. You know, I think that goes some way for us to think about the fact that we should be doing all we can not to interfere with people's enjoyment of their rights. Preventing abuses by third parties is often where we kind of focus our efforts because we align ourselves much more with rights holders than duty bearers. But we must be taking proactive steps ourselves to help strengthen access to and realisation of rights.
So just a few very big, quite practical challenges in there. There's like things that actually, okay, we actually need to do that. And I think that challenge of actually acting as if you are a duty bearer, and actually many of us are, because we actually carry out functions on behalf of government, which we mustn't forget. So thank you, Lucy. There'll be more questions for you later. So just have a little rest and then we'll come back to you. So I'm really delighted to welcome Tressa Burke who is the director of Glasgow Disability Alliance, an organisation that I'm sure most of us have absolutely been aware of, particularly in all that you've done around COVID and the impacts of disabled people. And so, Tressa, I invite you to come and give us your reflections.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Good morning, everybody. I've made some notes here, so I'm going to look at my notes, but I'll be looking up as well. It's lovely to be with everybody. So thanks to Rebecca and to yourself, Ari, and to the Human Rights Consortium Scotland for inviting me. And it is a celebration of becoming an independent organisation and just what it means to be a human rights-based organisation. I was heavily involved in the founding days of the consortium, so I'm genuinely thrilled to see that we've come this far, thanks to your hard work and to the support of Amnesty Scotland as well. I firmly believe that Glasgow Disability Alliance is a human rights-based organisation, both in how we do what we do and in what we do. And I was asked to tell you what that looks like. And I could talk about the structure and the policies, and I will say something about our purpose and our culture and what we do. But first, I thought it was actually a useful reflection to talk about what a human rights-based organisation feels like. It feels like one where both staff and members and sometimes partner organisations say to me, and this does regularly happen, that they feel treated with dignity and respect, sometimes for the first time. It feels like a place where disabled staff know they'll be supported if they need an adjustment or an accommodation, but also somewhere that staff know, even if they're not a disabled person, that they'll be supported when life just gets in the way. And that happens to us all sometimes, like caring responsibilities or family pressures or general disasters. It feels like all of the staff team, no matter the level, understand the mission of the organisation and the values. And this is also evident amongst the members who are closely involved in the activities, the programmes and in the running of the organisation, because participation is actually at the heart of all that we do. Staff, board and members are heavily involved across a range of levels. And this participation drives a sense of ownership, a sense of belonging and an increased sense of control in setting the direction, the policies, the outcomes and activities which GDA focuses on. I.e. disabled people decide basically what we do as an organisation. They decide on our outcomes and they're involved in the monitoring and the evaluation of these at every level, including right up to board level. Since 2001, officially, GDA has been bringing disabled people together to build a strong community of identity. And that's really important. The strategic direction and responsibility for compliance and policies are set at the highest level by the board, who are themselves disabled people. Being a disabled people-led organisation is important because it means that the accountability of the organisation lies with disabled people ourselves. We also build lots of understanding so that disabled people can hold other people to account. And that's actually the nature of the work that we do. But at the heart of it, we ourselves are accountable and we are duty bearers too. Disabled people face barriers and inequality across all areas of life. And these barriers persist and multiply when our voices are left out of decisions that affect us. So our participation and lived experience are vital to achieving a fairer and more equal society and a better organisation and one that's based on human rights. Our accessible programmes remove barriers and build capacity to empower disabled people to be leaders in their own lives and communities and in driving progress towards equality and social justice. We're also based in the social model of disability and we're proud to be part of a disabled people-led history of social change rooted in the independent living movement. For centuries, disabled people were segregated from society, forced into institution and told it was for our own good. And out of this oppression, the independent living movement was born. Disabled people realise that the inequality and the exclusion that we face is not caused by our impairments or conditions, but by the barriers that we face in a world that just wasn't designed for us to be in. This means it's not disabled people who are needing to be fixed, but society. And this liberating ideology also helps drive our human rights-based approach because it's part of our work to increase disabled people's understanding of their own oppression, and that in turn empowers disabled people. And empowerment is both a process and an outcome of GDA's work. So we've got over 5,000 disabled members of all ages and types of conditions, impairments and diversities. And we provide programmes of support and learning, one-to-one coaching and development activities to over 1,000 disabled people per year. We also deliver supports around welfare rights through our Rights Now project and through our Future Visions project. We work around social care. Now, our programmes before COVID built disabled people's confidence, connections and participation in their own lives, families, communities and wider society. That's the work we do at an individual level. And then there's the work that we do together at a more collective level. Peer support is a fundamental pillar of our work and so important to building resilience and empowerment. So too is making everything accessible, and in ordinary times, we provide transport, personal assistance, accessible information and equipment to reduce barriers and make sure that everybody can get involved on the same level. We all rely on connections we have and the supports that sustain us, and disabled people are no different. But COVID has shown that there are definitely less lifelines, and nothing has shown that more actually than COVID. To develop empowerment and resilience amongst disabled people, part of the process is to help people recognise and build on their talents and strengths, and that boosts confidence. Often people have a sense of injustice about their lives and the barriers they face, and we harness this energy through the accessible sessions that we put on. We provide information and briefings about human rights and about rights to wider services, unpacking the discrimination and oppression that disabled people face. We use participative models to open dialogue and deliberation and support disabled people to define the issues that are important to them, the barriers, the priorities and the solutions. This is all part of the work we do to build our collective voice and our commitment to help disabled people understand and claim their rights in relation to policies, services and decisions that affect us, and that sometimes includes how money is spent. Ideally, we want to co-design services, policies and solutions, but that does all depend on power holders working with us across a range of areas. The panel principles are clearly evident within all that GDA does, and it contributes to the culture which I do believe is perpetuated by staff, members and the board in a virtuous cycle. It definitely does require leadership for sure, and investment in people. And one of the things I'd say in all honesty is that it takes much more time and much more emotional investment. I also want to be honest and say it's not always easy. We don't always get it right and we're always learning. And finally, it is a privilege to be able to work in this way, in a human rights-based way. It's something I'm really, really aware of. Not everybody believes that it's possible, maybe because of budgets or other constraints that they genuinely are facing, but it really is necessary, and nothing has shown it more than COVID, where people have needed human responses based on rights but delivered with compassion.
Thanks so much, Tressa. There's so many things I want to have a chat about, even that it's absolutely necessary, but it's not necessarily easy, but it's absolutely inspiring to hear about your way of even thinking about it and the whole culture around that. So as I said to Lucy, hold on, we're coming back with questions shortly. So thanks, Tressa. I now want to introduce Naomi McAuliffe, who is the Programme Director at Amnesty International in Scotland, who obviously I have been a direct colleague with over the last 4 years, but we're still going to share an office once we get back there. So Naomi, can I invite you to come and...
Yeah. Thanks very much. Thanks, Barry. And thanks so much, Tressa and Lucy as well. I think that they kind of perfectly set out a lot of the policies, the procedures and principles that are really, really helpful to have within a human rights organisation. But I'm sure we have all got experiences of working at different places that have got the right kind of policies, but the wrong kind of culture, or that they were never, you know, really realised the kind of the ideas and the principles behind them. You know, it's quite a cliche. People talk about how working for a trade union and how, you know, the workers at a trade union are the worst kind of treated. And I think that, you know, there's an element of truth in that. In a lot of third sector organizations and charities, we often talk about these kind of principles externally for other duty bearers or other people in power. But how much do we actually kind of live it ourselves? So what I'm going to be talking about is the need for organisations who are want to be human rights based to keep a connection to and respond to social movements and external activism, and therefore to real people and lived experience. Because the policies, the procedures and the principles can and often do exist disconnected from people. You know, they're in HR policies, but they're not necessarily part of the day-to-day conversation within an organisation. So I think it's really important that you have them, like that you definitely need all of these policies, you definitely need the panel principles. But let's also talk about having that kind of human and emancipatory connection as well. So at Amnesty, we're both a professional human rights organisation and an activist organisation. And therefore, we tend to employ staff who are also activists. And it is part of our day-to-day work to support, enable and empower activists and supporters to take action and campaign on human rights issues. We're also part of a global human rights movement, which interacts with other new or well-established movements across the world. We're in that very privileged position, but I think lots of organisations are in similar kind of places or should connect to those movements too. So it's certainly an aspect of who we are as an organisation, but I think we do need to constantly try to mainstream it into how we operate as well. We, like many other organisations, particularly those who, you know, originate from a movement or a group of activists or right holders who get together to address an issue or an injustice, go through a period of professionalisation. And that often creates tensions, but it's also part of how organisations grow and hopefully start addressing issues in a systemic way as well. But I think we do need to remind ourselves that we're part of civil society. Our organisations are civil society citizens, and we should be connected to and respond to what's happening around us as well. As everyone will know here, the human rights movement and international legal framework has been constantly challenged, expanded and evolved by movements for emancipation. We not only have the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights and Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, we went on to have international human rights treaties as a specific response to social movements' call for rights recognition. So the campaigning of the women's rights movement led to the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, kind of campaigning on race equality led to Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, as Tressa has been talking about, the campaigning of disabled people leading to that. So I think as organisations that aspire to be human rights-based, we need to understand and acknowledge the role of social movements and activism in furthering and evolving our understanding of human rights on a personal and organisational level. You know, human rights are a living instrument, they're a discussion, they're a dialogue, and it's not just about having the right policies and templates at one point, at one time. It's about keeping them under review, changing them in line with new developments and responding to changes in society in a positive and progressive way. So as a kind of clear example of this, and there's lots of different examples that I could use, but I'm going to talk a bit about how the Black Lives Matter movement has affected us as an organisation, which I think gives a few kind of ideas or suggestions or pointers for how organisations can and should connect to movements and learn from them. So firstly, members of staff, both past and present, as well as our activists and supporters, are part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And when they were drawing attention to racism they suffer in their day-to-day lives, they're also talking about racism that they encounter at work as well. And in a white majority organisation, the experience of Black colleagues and employees was brought to the fore, and not for the first time as well. So responding to a human rights movement or particular external campaign must not just be about external organisational messaging. We were putting out kind of solidarity actions on our social media, but we also had to consider the fact that this was an issue within our organisation as well, which is how I'm going to move on to kind of the second point, which is don't think that because we work for a charity or third sector organisation or human rights organisation, that your organisation is inherently good and therefore all of your staff is inherently good. So there's no way we can be racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever. There is a huge problem of kind of organisational smugness causing and exacerbating marginalisation internally. And there's been a really great campaign, which you might have seen on social media, called Charity So White, which has done a huge amount of work to draw attention to why and how charities and international NGOs are dominated by white middle-class people and how problematic that is, especially when those organisations are working on race issues or issues that are exacerbated by racism. And this campaign has looked at where there are barriers to BAME people entering the charity and third sector, and want to kind of particularly highlight the example of Stonewall, who have been working with Charity So White in their recruitment processes. So if you've seen any adverts for Stonewall recently, they mention in their adverts that they'd be working with Charity So White. This isn't just for their adverts, it's been across their recruitment practices and their internal policies. And that's a really important signal being sent out to BAME people about going to work for that organisation and what they're hopefully going to encounter when they get there. So I think that's a really good positive example. We needed to create spaces where staff and stakeholders and others can raise issues and discuss and address them without fear of reprisals or being thought of as disloyal or being too kind of, you know, staff being told they're being too internally focused or distracting from the organisation's mission. So we held listening sessions where senior managers would listen to the concerns of Black members of staff in a way that, you know, they wouldn't interrogate them. It wouldn't result in any negative or disciplinary action being taken. And although that sounds like an obvious thing that that should happen, actually a lot of people have a lot of fear of that happening to them. So you have to be, I think, very overt, create those spaces and give assurances about safety to staff members that they can raise these issues and there's not going to be kind of hurt or blowback from doing that. And that people, you need to listen as well. It's not just about, you know, listening to all of these things, but also kind of actually properly hearing them, not just holding these sessions and walking away, which kind of leads on to the next point, which is that we need to take concrete action. And it's not kind of good enough to say, this is all very sad, but there's nothing we can do, or make excuses like, you know, we'd like to be recruiting more people from a certain kind of background or whatever, but, you know, people just don't apply for the jobs. What can we do? Oh, well, there are often like plenty of resources out there that you can call on as an organization and help and support to address these kind of issues in a concrete way. So, for example, I don't know if we've hired yet, but we certainly put out an advert for a race expert to look at our internal processes and make recommendations for change. I've mentioned Charity So White, which have been doing supportment for recruitment. But we've also hiring a separate member of staff who is going to be informing all of our external work as well and our campaigns and policy to make sure, again, that the race analysis that we're putting out is good, it's up to date, we're not reinforcing any kind of stereotypes, which from an international NGO point of view is a particular issue. Again, you may have heard about a lot of the kind of conversations going around about white savior complex and other things like that. So we need to make sure that it's internal as well as in our external work too. So having specific staff positions are important and they demonstrate impact. And we've done this previously as well. We've had gender mainstreaming positions too. And they don't just put all of the problem onto the job role of people who raise the issue. So for example, women who complain about certain policies then being asked to go and draw up those policies themselves. You know, it's better to kind of bring in that resource to show that kind of commitment as an organisation. And we've also got to make sure, again, connected to that, that it's not just the role of the rights holders to do all of the work themselves. So when Black people raise issues about racism, white colleagues often then ask them to train the rest of the staff and to, you know, they have to do the work for us. But instead, what we've been looking at within the organisation is to explore issues around white supremacy, where Black staff can obviously take part, but it's not their responsibility to educate their white colleagues in this. So we've been having reading circles where staff can get together and be reading books such as on white fragility or Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race. You know, somewhere that people can come together and talk about these issues and get into some kind of depth about them, because this is going on outside, it's all surrounding us. And we do need to kind of work through this on a personal level, but also in terms of our work and our workspace as well. So there are lots of reading lists out there. You can circulate them, you can allow staff to have space where they can talk about this. And talk about it in terms of learning and development as well, in the same way that we get training on how to use Excel or how to be a good line manager, you know, making sure that people have got time and space to learn about human rights issues, about concepts and tensions is also, I think, really, really beneficial. So these are just some kind of ideas and thoughts and some suggestions. you'll all have your own as well. And I really hope you'll be able to share them and we can learn from each other, because we're not saying we've got all the answers. As I say, what I'm describing is a kind of recent illustration of us getting it wrong and needing to respond to that. But it is about learning those lessons and sharing those experiences and learning from one another. And I hope that's what we're going to get from the discussion next. So thanks.
Thanks so much, Naomi. Again, there's so many really strong things in there that we really need to take away and reflect on, like create the spaces actually for people to be listened to, but then also take the action. And then it's not down to rights holders to be the ones to sort it. It's for others to really act on it. So loads of really strong points there. So thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here, and hope you have a good day.